connection between two neurons. Just wanted to remind Kandel's, Eric Kandel, Nobel Prize for medicine hypothesis quite a while ago already, which was really like groundbreaking. Synaptic changes parallel behavioral changes. At neuronal level, learning is actually creating new synapses, reinforcing existing ones, weakening existing synapses if they are no longer needed, or pruning them. And that is that you can define at neuronal level the very act of learning just by observing what's happening in the synaptic cleft, that is where the neurotransmitters are conducted from one neuron to another. Not at cell level yet, and I'm not sure it's really useful, but to observe activation patterns shows what learning actually is at biological level. So we have a formation and elimination of synapses during, well, all of our life, even before birth, actually. You have here, on the right-hand side, the number of synapses that has been measured depending on age. It's a log scale, of course. I mean, the x-axis is a log scale, which I find quite interesting, by the way. And that it shows that it's at the age of 8 months that the density of synapses is at its peak, at least as far as the primary visual area is concerned, but there is no reason to believe that it's very different in other brain areas. That is extremely interesting because with this, we can sort of hypothesize, and actually it makes sense, that it's probably in the first year of our life that we actually learn the most, even if, of course, we don't remember it, etc. But there is a great activation of synapses there, but nobody has ever said that the quantity of learning, whatever that is a direct function of the synaptic connectivity. When I was a child, I remember in the biology course, there was something absolutely terrifying that I heard. I was 12 or 13 or something like that, and the biology teacher told us something like this. I'm pretty sure some of you have heard the same thing. He said, look, you are born with a certain number of neurons, a lot of them, millions of them, billions of them, but you lose thousands and thousands of neurons every single day. And you don't get new ones. I was terrified when I heard that. So, does that mean that I become more and more stupid with every day? And you know, when you are 12 or 13, you just have to observe the world around to see some sort of confirmation of that hypothesis. So the fact of the matter is that not only neurogenesis, the creation of new neurons, was not known back then. You know, it's prehistorical. When I was in my teens, can you imagine? It was the early 70s, you know. Anyway, and second, the number of neurons is actually very, very little to do with the intensity of learning or whatsoever. The synaptic connectivity has a relationship, but it's not that obvious yet. And above all, there is synaptogenesis and neurogenesis. That means, yes, we lose thousands of neurons on a daily basis, but we also create new ones, and we constantly create, reinforce, and etc., new connections, new synapses, which makes our brain, as I said, a lifelong learning device. Look at this. Four pictures by an Austrian artist about a century ago. After suffering a stroke, he painted this as a self-portrait, right? He painted first this one, not noticing that it was incomplete because he had had a stroke and he had lost quite a lot of his brain functions. But then after a few years, he painted another self-portrait. It was that one. Then this one, and after 5 or 6 years, he was there. It was one century ago. He had not had been offered any sort of chemical or intervention or surgery or anything he wanted. It was simply not possible. His brain reconfigurated itself in order to compensate for the loss following the stroke. This is beautiful. Good news for us all. I could give tons of examples, but, well, time is limited. But I've seen people recovering from incredible stuff recently. Now, the problem with all this is all good news. The problem is that there are an awful lot of neuromyths all over the place, and they mushroom also on a daily basis. Like, for instance, I read somewhere that we use only 10% of our brain anyway. You've heard that sort of things. 10% or 20% or 25%. Now, well, come on. Again, some people say Einstein said that. I very much doubt it. Even if Einstein did not have imaging technology, he knew enough of evolution theory to find it extremely strange that evolution would have allowed an organ of the human brain, which accounts for 2% of the weight of the body, and in someone like me, probably even less than that, because of that weight, to spend 25% of the energy. I mean, come on. When you look at the activation of a brain at any moment, it looks like a Christmas tree or something like that. There is no such thing as a brain that works for 10% or 25% or etc., at least as far as I know. Other people said, George W. Bush said that. They were in that case, let's just call it overgeneralization. All right. Or, I'm a left brain, she's a right brain person. Great. I mean, each time I hear that, it's much, much more frequent on the other side of the Atlantic. So, well, look, I hope I'm a full brain person to begin with. Now, if you have problems at home, you know, in your couple, and if you can't solve the problem by saying, you know, we disagree and we have this fight or this struggle, etc., just because you're left brain, I'm right brain, so this is fine with me. Everything that brings peace between people is fine in principle, but you should know that it's simply not true. There is no such thing as left brain or right brain people. Myth. Or just men and boys have different brains from women and girls. Well, again, experience or daily observation could lead us to this sort of conclusions. However, yes, it is true to some extent because our brains are the result of a product of genetics on the one hand and the environment on the other. And the environment teaches us to be a boy or a girl, to be a man or a woman, and etc., and it might impact the brain. But if you try to look for explanations for the gender gap, achievement gap, you know, at schools, the fact that boys are doing better this or doing better that, doesn't seem to be the case anymore anywhere, or that girls outperform boys in so many areas and in so many disciplines and etc., then don't look for the explanation anywhere in neuroscience. You won't find it. Look for it in sociology, anthropology, whatever, you know, but not neuroscience. And a lot of neuromyth based on, you know, for commercial purposes, improve your memory, train this, train that. Learn while you sleep, you know, you remember that sort of things that was done, especially in the 60s and starts to be sort of revived. This is completely crazy, but it's like that, you know, just like while you sleep, have a CD or tape recorder or anything, reading aloud The Idiot. And at the end of the story, or another novel by Dostoevsky, if you want that. Anyway, at the end of the story, you will speak Russian. I mean, come on, I want to see that. I don't buy it. And worse than anything else, there is no time to lose, as everything important about the brain is decided by the age of 3, or by the age of 5, or by the age of... No. Plasticity of the brain allows us... This, in my view, is a terrifying neuromyth. First of all, because it puts an awful lot of pressure on parents. You know, you receive this baby, especially when it's your first one. You say, well, what is it I have to do with this little thing in order to have 3 years to go? After it will be too late. Come on, give me a break. Some people say, play Mozart music to your babies. They will get smarter. No, sorry. They won't get smarter. I mean, there's nothing wrong with playing Mozart to the babies. It will be easier for their sleep than if you play, I don't know, Slipknot or Marilyn Manson. That's for sure. But they won't get smarter. And the same thing, they are critical parents with certain matters can must be taught and learned. If you just want to have more information about this, there is this book, which we published 5 years ago already. So it should be prehistoric, kind of. But as far as education is concerned, or the relevant pieces for education, it still seems more or less okay. And there is a follow-up that has just been published, which uses a lot of neuroscience too, of course, because I was basically involved in both things, so I did that too. This language is in a global world. which draws a lot on what we have learned about bilingualism and the way we acquire languages and etc. from what we have learned from neuroscience, but also from all sorts of other disciplines, such again as sociology, anthropology, history, politics, and etc., etc. Now, ethics in the brain as a sort of conclusion for today. Look at these two kids. Don't know if you know them. These are the grown-ups, the same kids grown up. You certainly know them. Well, I mean, you've heard of them. These two individuals can probably be considered to be situated at the extremes of an ethical scale. If you look at them, if you look at their background, well, of course, except for the fact that one was German and the other one was Indian, well, they were born more or less in the same sort of social conditions. They were sent to the same kind of school. They had the same sort of education, etc., etc. How does one become Mohandas Gandhi, and how does one become Heinrich Himmler? Well, one of these days, the question is just, you know, might seem very speculative or philosophical, but it's not. One of these days, something will happen, and it's not very far. Are human beings born unequal when it comes to ethics? Or are ethical standards acquired? Or both, nature and nurture? We are on the verge of discovering the biological mechanisms of ethics within the brain. We are very, very close to that. It will happen in the years to come. It will be described and etc. Now, this might dramatically modify our philosophical and political views, our conceptions of education, and even the ways we perceive ourselves as a species. And remember, there is no such thing as a neutral science. If being human is to feel empathy, we all know that some people are more empathetical than others, which doesn't mean ethical, by the way. If you are unethical and you want to harm others, the more empathetic you are, the better, because it's much easier to harm someone when you feel, well, you know what I mean. Where do the differences come from, potentially? Just as there are three options. It's nature. We are pre-programmed by our genes. It's nurture. It's acquired through the environment, particularly through education, or it's a combination of both. And certainly most neuroscientists would agree that it's a combination of both. However, and that's the problem, the third explanation is probably not going to please the media because it's too complex, it's too complicated. One day, a lab will publish a result in a scientific journal and it will reach the popular press, which will simplify, oversimplify, and again oversimplify the whole thing until it reaches television. And on television, it will be presented in 15, 20, or 30 seconds. And it will go like this. Some people are born unethical. This is genetics. Wow. Or it will be the other way around. We are all born equal, sort of, when it comes to ethics, but our environment, which means our education, makes us people with high ethical standards or not, basically in the direction of Gandhi or in the direction of Himmler. Now, if this comes across through the mass media, then you can imagine the political debate that will follow. You can imagine the impact on the education systems and practices. How would you react if you knew, for instance, when you start the school or the academic year, that some of your students are extremely ethical and some others are not, for whatever reason? How would you react in a courtroom if something like that is described, you know, with the reinforcement that an arcane science can give, with the sort of extremely positive aura that scientists have? This is the problem. Just an example. I don't want to, you know, play the apocalypse bird. Certainly not. But it's an example, and this is going to happen. We'd better start to think about it right away. It's Scylla or Charybdis. We have to choose between these two dangers. The mass media are not equipped to deal with complexity, be it scientific or not. We know that. We see that on a daily basis. And I'm pretty sure it's not very different here in the Netherlands as it is in France, in Germany, in the UK, in Italy, or elsewhere, to say nothing of the US. Anyway. So that might be the hardest challenge for our democratic societies in the 21st century. Our democracies need free press and free media and etc. However, when as citizens we need to be well informed about issues that are supposed to be decided by public opinion and hence by an informed public opinion, and we have to rely on the mass media, especially for complex scientific questions, how do you want to do that? With the sort of logic that is developed today, it's impossible. That's the reason why I say the following. If we admit a cascade that starts from ethics, you know, on a sort of axis between good and bad, and that from there, according to traditional Plato's Republic, traditional Greek or, say, Western political philosophy, we derive politics, what is desirable or not desirable, again on an axis. It's not as simple as that, of course. And then policies, feasible, not feasible, and practices, efficient, not efficient, and after, it loops, so to say, back like this. Now, what is the role of ethics in all this? It is the very, very basis of the whole cascade. What is good and what is bad? What we consider good, what we consider bad. Do you see science anywhere here? No, not yet. It will come. But I don't think that we should replace ethics with science in a way or another. This is not only not feasible, it is not the role of science. Science is not here to tell us what is good or bad, what is desirable or not. Science is not here to tell us what we want to do with our kids. Science is not here to say what we want for our world in the future. And it comes to global warming. That's the reason why I had this in the topic. Scientists can tell us, well, look, if it goes on like this, there will be trouble. However, normally they don't say, hence, do this, don't do that, do that. This is a political decision. And it's up to us, especially here in Europe. I don't think there is any sort of debate about whether people believe in global warming or not. There is global warming. It is a fact. And now, do we want to deal with it? Yes or no? On the other side of the Atlantic, there is a debate, as you may have heard. Again, candidates for the presidential election saying, I never believed in that. If I had been there, I said, well, look, I've never believed that the Earth is round. But anyway, now, let's look at this. Let's separate heuristically emotions in the brain, positive, negative, and reason ideas, true, false. Sciences derive or are born from reason and ideas. Yeah, okay, I finish. And the arts are derived from emotions. But of course, it's a bit more complicated than that. Everything plays a role there. Ethics, good and bad, derived from both of them. Now, sorry, I ran out of time. So the sciences are here. They are born from ideas and philosophies, and they sort of separate themselves and come back to philosophy in a way or another. And when they want to address the cascade, they have to go through the prism and the filter of the media, which obey an economic logic, an economy of a logic of more or less, and a media impact on these cascades, but not without having completely deformed, put through the prism, the messages from science. And this is the problem we have to deal with. Science is not only not equipped to tell us what to do, it is not its role, but moreover, the messages we as citizens, as human beings, receive from science are not actually, unless we are ourselves specialists in one discipline, but I talked about global warming. I'm not a climatologist. I don't know anything about it. So I have to rely on the mass media, which probably give me an oversimplified picture of the whole. After one look at this planet, any visitor from outer space would say, I want to see the manager. This comes from William Burroughs. If I had met with him, unfortunately I didn't, I would have told him, you know, Bill, I agree with you. But on the other hand, don't you think we are the managers? Anyway, I hope I have given you a sort of glimpse of the issues, the possibilities, etc. Just a glimpse. But you don't have to believe it. as Russell again said, I shouldn't wish people dogmatically to believe any philosophy, not even mine. Especially, I don't think that any brain is powerful enough when alone. I believe in collective intelligence. The rising brain is something that we can build together in order to dance with our intelligence and make it more powerful in order to, without forgetting spiritual uplift, keep our feet on earth to make this place a better place to live. But damn it.
Thank you very much, Bruno, for that very stimulating talk. We've run out of time, but I think it would be a shame not just to have a couple of questions. So please put up your hand.
Yeah, please shoot. And in any event, if you have things that come to your mind and would like to discuss with me, because I believe in collective intelligence, so I need you, I need your help. Here are my email addresses. Use the Harvard one, especially if you write after the summer. But now, every remark or challenge or question is welcome.
I have a question from Jens.
Thank you, Bruno, for a stimulating talk. We worked together on the book on creating a learning science, and I just want you to comment on the situation we see today, because there's lots of debate about the relationship between education, educational research, and neuroscience, as you indicated. Yeah. But there's one area I think I would like your opinion about, because what we see now in economics is a huge influence, what is called behavioral economics. And that is, I mean, just this year, I think it was last year, maybe the book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow, was published. Yeah. And that's more or less based on very important development, dual process theory in understanding cognition, and which has, of course, educational implications. But it's transforming economics in the sense of creating not sort of the axiomatic mathematical economics that we know, but a behaviorally, that is, a psychologically realistic economics. Mm-hmm. So I thought that what would be appropriate today would be to see if it can transform economics in some interesting ways. Why don't we look at it and see how it could do something for education also?
Well, that's great stuff, actually. Hans, if you're starting something on this in Denmark and you think I can be of any help, I'd be happy to come. However, well, you've heard about neuroeconomics. I mean, there are a lot of neuro-whatever things developing all over the place. Neuroeconomics might actually have a traditional neoliberal kind of economic models and ideology and etc., departing from this completely rational sort of the rational human being, which we know as psychologists is simply does not exist. However, a lot of the way our economists view society and our societies is based on this wrong assumption. Could it be, and if I don't misunderstand your question, could it be that some insights or discoveries from neuroscience applied to economics in a way or another might actually persuade these people that they have been dramatically wrong for decades? I very much hope so. I very much hope so, Hans, really, for us all, for our children, etc. However, may I quote Stiglitz? You know, last week I was in Cambridge with Howard Gardner, and the week before with him again in Paris, and he told me the following story. He asked Stiglitz, well, you all know him, Nobel Prize for Economy, what changed, actually, in the view of economists after the 2008 crisis? And Stiglitz said, absolutely nothing. So if the 2008 crisis changed nothing, and we know that it's true, then I wonder what kind of scientific evidence could actually change anything. In this way, I'm a bit pessimistic. But maybe, again, the power... power is not the right word, but the potential impact of an arcane science coming and say, look, guys, you've been working on complete wrong assumptions for decades, if not centuries, might actually change something. Or maybe it will be the two forces joined together science on the one hand, and probably as we start to observe, especially here in Europe in some countries, you know what I'm talking about, people starting to react and say, well, look, guys, this is not possible. We simply can't go on like this. Let's be optimistic anyway. I'm a pessimist, but I want to be optimistic for the future.
Thanks very much. One quick final question? No? Well, my question is, are you saying we have to rely on the media as the basis for our collective intelligence?
Well, for the moment, there is no other choice, unfortunately. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I was talking about the mass media, you know. Collective intelligence can actually probably be much better developed by the sort of new media, you know, the internet and et cetera, and bottom-up initiatives. Unfortunately, until recently, and again today, for the information we receive and et cetera, we depend a lot on the traditional mass media, especially television, which is dramatically not equipped to deal with complexity, as I said, and certainly not equipped to develop collective intelligence. And actually, in many places, as I see it, and my friend Noam Chomsky certainly doesn't disagree with that, is actually there in order to keep people stupid and to sort of make sure that no collective intelligence will develop at any time. You know.
Well, let's keep with the positive of the social media rather than the negative. Thanks again, Bruno.